From GPB News, this is On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. Tomorrow is Super Tuesday, so we'll start with a preview of who might win Georgia's nomination and who might come in second. Plus, we'll speak with Jason Carter about the attitudes on the death penalty and whether or not they're changing. Then, Atlanta soul singer William Bell's songs have been covered by and sampled by artists from Billy Idol to Ludacris. That's all coming up. First, though, last night was the 88th Academy Awards, and the issue of diversity took center stage pretty much all night. Noticeably absent from the audience was director Spike Lee. He received an honorary Oscar, but boycotted the awards ceremony because no actor of color was nominated. We spoke with Morehouse professor Stephanie Dunn, who uses Spike Lee's films to teach students about history and culture.
We go right at his presentation and his delivery. We've discussed his choices in being very direct, how that might deter some audiences or disturb audiences, but that's what he wants to do, is to disturb and provoke.
Here are your first thoughts.
Brad Sanders. I think Spike Lee's greatest achievement in movie making is the fact that he was able to get movies made. He had the tenacity and the ability to make movies, to get an independent film done many times, and he introduced to us some of our greatest actors. So for that, I am very grateful.
We always love to hear your thoughts. How do you think that Oscars handled the diversity issue? Were you a fan? Did you watch, or did you boycott like Spike did? Call us at 404-500-9457. You can also tweet us at OST Talk or post on Facebook. We might feature your comments on the show. Tomorrow is the SEC primary for Georgia and six other southern states. Presidential hopefuls have flooded the states with campaign dollars, ads, speeches, their faces. Who will come away big winners in the South? Here to give us a preview of tomorrow's primary is GPB's own Bill Nigut. He's the host of Political Rewind. It's always good to see you here. And also with us is Andra Gillespie. She's a political science professor at Emory University. And it's always good to see you as well, Andra.
Thank you.
So, Bill, right now, and correct me if I'm wrong, the polls show a very strong lead for both Donald Trump for the GOP and Clinton for the Democrats. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right, Celeste. I think it is unlikely that tomorrow night we're going to see any surprises in terms of winners. I think Trump has a commanding lead in virtually every poll we've seen on the Republican side. And Hillary Clinton's had a big lead as well, and especially after watching the way she absolutely obliterated Bernie Sanders in South Carolina Saturday. I think that was really a preview of what we might expect here today.
Andra, does South Carolina and Georgia generally agree?
Well, I think in this case, what we're looking for, particularly on the Democratic side, is there are very similar demographics. And so what we are looking at is what the margin is going to look like among African-American voters, because that's going to drive Hillary Clinton's overall vote totals. And Hillary Clinton got 84% of the African-American vote in South Carolina, and her poll numbers here were strong. And so you have undecideds here. So if those undecideds break for Clinton, then she will perform at least within the ballpark there.
Okay, let me play you, Bill, this comment from Lisa Gordon, one of our listeners. She actually voted in early voting on Friday, and here she is explaining why she voted for the person she voted for.
I'm voting for Bernie Sanders because I like his message of togetherness. I like his ideas that the people who are working hard and punching a time clock are the ones who should be getting a little bit more for the hard work they put in. And I don't know that he has much of a chance. That's the candidate I'm backing.
So, Bill, we've actually seen a number of very well-attended campaign events in Atlanta, particularly among young people at universities. And there's been obviously a strong endorsement from Atlanta rapper Killer Mike. Is part of the reason Bernie may not do well in Georgia because young people don't vote?
Well, I mean, that's always a possibility. We don't know. Andra, you were at the rally at Morehouse College, and it was really well attended. But from all reports, including what you've said, Andra, it although that a lot of students showed up who could be potential young voters, I don't think people came away feeling that this was a group that was motivated to go out and support Sanders, because he really hasn't proven himself as a real friend of the African-American community, right?
So, I mean, it was staged at Morehouse, and it was clearly done to target young African-American voters. And so what I was struck by was the fact that probably about half, maybe slightly less than half of those in attendance at that rally were not Black. And one of the things that also struck me was, as everybody was walking toward their cars to leave, you could see the Morehouse students doing their own thing, actually walking against the tide to go to the library, go to the dining hall. It was Tuesday night for them. It wasn't a special night. So, you know, Sanders is taking a risky strategy by banking on young voters who have the lowest propensity turnout of any age group to turn out and vote. And he still hasn't made the case yet with African-American voters. One interesting thing from South Carolina, if you talk to reporters who can dig down a little bit deeper into the exit poll data, there are differences by generation in terms of African-American levels of support for Bernie Sanders. So in South Carolina, for voters age 18 to 30, 43% of them voted for Bernie Sanders. Now, amongst their grandparents' generation, those over 65, that was 3%.
Yeah, even Sanders mentioned that after when he gave a speech in which he talked about the South Carolina results. He acknowledged that he was wiped out. But you're right. He said older African-Americans voted for Hillary Clinton. Still trying to cling to that claim that if young voters will turn out, they'll vote for
him.
Which
is odd. He's the oldest candidate in the race.
Yes.
Right.
Well, let's spend the rest of our time talking about the GOP race, because arguably it's more interesting. Mm-hmm. And I let me go with you, Bill, and I'm going to ask you as well, Andra, is why is Georgia turning out, at least in the primaries, for Donald Trump?
Well, I mean, Trump has excited those people in the Republican base, and really beyond Republicans. He's tapped into that anger, that disenchantment we hear so much about, the alienation that voters are feeling from their government in Washington. He's a TV star. He's an entertainer. He's generated enormous amount of excitement, I think. And Andre, you may have a different take on this, largely among people who never necessarily paid a whole lot of attention to politics before, but they feel like they're part of that Donald Trump excitement and that anger that he has tapped into, right?
And so there's this interesting logic that I think is going on in the minds of Trump voters. So, yes, it's attracting people who are first-time voters. Yes, it's attracting more blue-collar voters. Yes, it's attracting voters who harbor racial resentment, as evidenced by some of the polling data where 20% of them are cool with slavery and other kinds of things.
Wait. 20% of Donald Trump supporters would have been okay with slavery continuing?
Well, they took issue with the Emancipation Proclamation as an example of executive overreach is the proper way to put that.
Okay.
And so, yes, we know that all of those elements are there. But then the logic of it is Washington is broken. So why do we keep on putting the same people back in to fix it? So in their minds, it is illogical or insane to keep on electing the same people to office and expecting them to behave any differently. So let's try this outsider. And so that outsider strain is why Carly Fiorina had some traction for a little bit. It's why Ben Carson had some traction for a little bit. And it just turns out that Donald Trump rose, you know, to the top in that particular pool. And then also, even though Sanders has been in Congress for decades at this point, the fact that he's not considered part of the Democratic establishment also explains part of that attraction for him as well.
But again, as part of this notion of him being an entertainer, he's the most spontaneous candidate.
Donald Trump, not Bernie Sanders.
Donald Trump. He's the most spontaneous candidate we've ever seen. There is no fourth wall with Donald Trump. He goes to rallies, as you well know. He talks about, he reviews his own performances. Mm-hmm. He is completely transparent. We're seeing in him, he's bringing in his supporters and letting him behind the wall to see what the machinery is really like.
For good or ill.
Yeah, of course. And people are finding that, wow, here's a spontaneous guy. Remember, Marco Rubio has been tagged as the robot candidate for so long. Well, Trump's the opposite of that. And I think there are a lot of people out there who find that, after all of the pre-programmed campaigns, very appealing.
Yeah. If you're just joining us, my guests are GPB's Bill Nigut and political science professor Andra Gillespie. They're here with a preview of tomorrow's SEC presidential primary. Andra, why doesn't it matter how many times Donald Trump gets caught in, say, a lie, or how many times he's accused, sometimes through legal proceedings of fraud. Why doesn't it matter, all those things that make a candidate shady?
Well, you know, we don't know the answer to this question yet. And this raises all kinds of questions that I think we're going to be testing empirically for the next couple of years to try to figure it out. I think for many people, they are just so opposed to the status quo that they're willing to take anything from anybody. And I think also at this point, timing may matter. And so the idea that this stuff started to come out as it looked like people were, you know, actively attempting to try to take him out, sort of to some people looks like there's a conspiracy behind it. And so that for that reason, they're going to double down and continue to support their candidate no matter what. Now, that to be said, you know, Marco Rubio just started to trot out the con artist theme, you know, in the last couple of days. And so we will see tomorrow whether or not that actually has had any traction, whether or not that's the message that's actually going to work with voters at this point.
But Bill, to what extent is this a serious identity crisis on the part of the GOP? Because we're seeing major thinkers, David Brooks, all kinds of people saying this could be the end of the Republican Party as we know it.
There's no question they are in deep crisis and they don't know what to do. I mean, you've now suddenly, what's really remarkable this weekend is you've now got mainstream Republican leaders, or at least establishment Republicans, who are breaking with the party.
Lindsey Graham, notably.
Well, Lindsey Graham, of course, was, you know, he's not going to back Donald Trump. He's on the side that says we've got to maintain order. On the other side, you've now got Alabama Senator Jeff Sessions endorsing Donald Trump. That's kind of spins your brain around because that shows you. You got Sessions on one side. You've got a Lindsey Graham on the other. The party is absolutely in deep, deep crisis.
So in terms of what we can expect tomorrow, we've talked about who may win. But what do we expect in terms of turnout?
So historically, so what we've seen so far this cycle is that turnout has been extremely robust on the Republican side and not so much on the Democratic side. And so I would expect, I mean, we already know here in Georgia that there was record turnout for early voting.
Which ended Friday.
And from the polls based on early voting on the Republican side, Trump was winning amongst the early voters in particular. So what we will expect is that we're going to see very, very robust turnout amongst Republicans, and then we wait to see whether or not turnout is relatively anemic amongst Democrats.
And, Bill, we have about 30 seconds. Who might take second place? Isn't that maybe more competitive on the
yes,
GOP
side?
Is.
Yes, it is, and it's very important. Rubio and Cruz are in a real fight for that, but I suggest Texas is going to be more important for second place or first place than Georgia, because if Ted Cruz wins Texas, he stays in the race. If he loses, he's probably not going much further. But it will be interesting to see which of the two of them is second here.
Hopefully we can hear from all of our listeners out there as you go to vote tomorrow. Maybe you've already voted through early voting. Bill Nigut is the host of Political Rewind here on GPB. Andra Gillespie is a political science professor at Emory University. Thanks so much to both of you.
Thank you.
This is On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. The history of the death penalty in the U.S. is long and it's pretty complicated. In 1972, the U.S. Supreme Court struck down the death penalty after a ruling on a Georgia case. 4 years later, the court reversed that decision with another Georgia case. And since then, the state has executed 62 people here in Georgia. How does the public feel and think about capital punishment, though? Our opinion might be changing, and it was the focus of a recent panel discussion at the State Bar of Georgia Conference Center. Attorney Jason Carter moderated that panel. He's a former lawmaker and now chairs the Carter Center in Atlanta. And Jason joins me in the studio. Welcome.
Thank you.
First, can we go back to those really quickly to give people context, go back to those Georgia cases which both struck down the death penalty and then brought it back legislatively? Give me an overview of where we stand on the death penalty when it comes to the courts and how it can be applied.
Well, originally, of course, the death penalty as a mode of punishment has been around in the world for ever. What happened with the first Supreme Court decision that you were talking about and that Justice Fletcher, who was our former Chief Justice here in Georgia, mentioned during our panel, the Supreme Court of the United States said it could no longer be used in the country. Then they brought it back. At that point, states were able to decide for themselves. And Georgia is one of the states that does continue to allow juries to impose the death penalty.
Well, this is, again, those courses came within 4 years ago. So here is Justice Potter Stewart, and he's delivering the opinion and comparing those two cases.
Left unguided, juries imposed the death sentence in a way that could only be called freakish. The new Georgia sentencing procedures, by contrast, focus the jury's attention on the particularized nature of the crime and the particularized characteristics of the individual defendant.
What does that mean, that they focus jury's attention on the particularized nature of the crime?
Well, in Georgia, in order to impose the death penalty, both the prosecutor originally is required to find and be able to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that there are what they call aggravating circumstances associated with the crime. One of the interesting things that the panelists discussed and the two panelists that you mentioned were Danny Porter, the district attorney in Gwinnett County, the longest serving DA in the state, and then former Chief Justice Norman Fletcher. And one of the debates that they had was on whether you could find these extenuating circumstances in any murder. And in that context, the Justice Fletcher's position was that it's very difficult to look at one type of murder and say that it's worse than another. And Danny Porter, on the other hand, said that that he could do it, and that there was no doubt that juries take this very seriously.
Well, there's also no doubt that the majority of Americans still believe the death penalty is justified in some cases. Here is Gwinnett County District Attorney Dana Porter in that panel talking about why he believes the death penalty can prevent greater damage.
I've seen things that none of you have seen. I don't believe, particularly in light of an arrest we made in Gwinnett County last week where a gang member ordered a hit out of a prison with a smuggled cell phone, that life without parole adequately protects society. And I believe that there are some crimes for which no other punishment is appropriate.
However, public opinion is changing on the death penalty in spite of that. And I wonder, to what extent is it the confirmation we've had recently that we have executed innocent people in the United States?
Well, I think one of the things that you'll see, and Justice Fletcher himself is a good example of people changing their opinion over time. And Justice Fletcher was on the Supreme Court here in Georgia for many, many years and was the Chief Justice for many years when the court oversaw and affirmed death sentences. And later on, as he examined that system and as he himself went through a personal journey with respect to this, he has changed his mind and believes that it is no longer appropriate to have the death penalty in Georgia. I think you'll see as people demand more from the criminal justice system and as people are given other options, we have in fact seen in the last 3 years in Georgia zero death sentences in 2013, one in 2014, and zero in 2015. So there is a reduction in the number of death sentences that are being meted out by Georgia's juries.
If you're just joining us, I'm speaking with Attorney Jason Carter. He moderated a panel recently on the death penalty that was for the State Bar of Georgia Conference Center. If you want to weigh in with your own opinion, you can tweet us at OST Talk or post on our Facebook page. I wonder what you think is the motivation behind the change. So we reached a high point in support for the death penalty in about 1994. That's when 80% of Americans said they supported the death penalty. Now a new Pew Research Center survey finds 56% favor the death penalty for people convicted of murder, which is a huge change. And what's behind that? Is it because, as I mentioned, that we have now discovered, especially through DNA, that we've executed innocent people? Is it partly because of the Black Lives Matter movement and the idea that justice is sometimes rendered not impartially?
I think there's no doubt that the public perception of the criminal justice system has changed. And part of it is, you know, you often hear prosecutors complain about the CSI effect, which is, you know, we have so much data, so much DNA, for example, that can make or break a particular case. And at the same time, you have, as you mentioned, movements and groups of people who feel dramatically alienated from the criminal justice system. And so in my personal view, I think that what you've seen is many states giving options like life without parole that allow juries more ability. But I think you also just have, and one of the things that Danny Porter mentioned to me, who's the prosecutor, was that a lot of people will say they support the death penalty. But when you get into a courtroom and you look across the room at another human being and you are on a jury who's charged with determining whether to take that person's life, it's a very, very deep, visceral, incredible reaction and responsibility. And I think that correctly, people are just taking that responsibility more and more seriously, and therefore it's reducing the number of death penalties.
Let me actually play a comment from the panel discussion that you had. Again, this is Gwinnett County District Attorney Danny Porter speaking on Friday about what goes through the minds of a jury that may have to consider the death sentence.
One of the common questions I ask is, what's the hardest decision you ever made in your life? And one little girl told me she had to decide between keeping a dog and giving up an apartment. And she gave up the dog so she could keep the apartment. I put her on a death penalty jury because I figured she'd put somebody in the electric chair for sure if she gave up a dog. You ask those questions to prepare the jurors for the gravity of what you do.
What I found interesting is there was another survey in which they asked not just, do you support the death penalty or do you not? But they worded it differently. They said, would you choose the death? Do you support the death penalty over life without parole? And in that case, more than half of Americans said they would not choose the death penalty. So you're saying that in Georgia, at least, people are choosing life without parole over the death penalty. Is that a national trend?
I believe that it is, although I haven't looked at the statistics. I think one of the fascinating things about this topic, and there's very few topics like this when you approach the politics of it or the policy making of it, where people just feel it. I mean, and when you heard Danny Porter talk about looking in the trunk of a car at a 2-year-old that had been burned and had kidnapped and killed, and his reaction was, there is no punishment that is appropriate enough besides the death penalty here. And there are people, I think, who believe that and who feel that. And I think Justice Fletcher's point, as he was talking about his sort of transformation with respect to this issue, is when he first began, it was easy for him to say, yeah, of course I support the death penalty, because that's just what people do. And I think that visceral reaction is real. But as you move forward in a system, as Justice Fletcher did, to and meet it out as a part of a very systematic approach, you end up just recognizing at a very fundamental level that there is something different about this topic. This is not just a policy decision. It's not just a political decision. It's something that people feel very deeply one way or the other in their heart.
Well, since you've mentioned Justice Fletcher, let's hear a comment from him. And this is retired Georgia Supreme Court Chief Justice Norman Fletcher talking about his change of heart on the death penalty.
I see the message of Jesus Christ is all about love, loving our neighbors. It's not about hating our enemies. It's about praying for those who persecute us. It's not about killing someone who harms our brother, sister, neighbor. It's about forgiveness, redemption, changed lives.
So, I mean, do you foresee a moment again when we are going to get rid of the death penalty, if not just in Georgia, but in the U.S.?
I think clearly, and as I said, and as that clip demonstrated, I mean, this is an issue that for many people is one of very foundational importance in their moral understanding of the world. And I think as we saw, whether the legislature abolishes death penalties in every state, whether they replace it with life without parole, or whether juries just sort of gradually stop awarding or meting out this particular punishment, even Danny Porter, who, as you heard, in his heart felt very strongly that it was an appropriate response to certain crimes, I think you're going to, even he was saying that, look, this moment in time, it is fading away from the public understanding of what's appropriate. And juries who are responsible for, again, looking across the courtroom at another human being and making a decision that their government is going to put that person to death are taking it seriously in a way, not that they haven't before, but that is an impactful and real moment for them that I think is going to change. And I do think that there will come a day when we don't do it in this country anymore.
Attorney Jason Carter, he's the chair of the Carter Center in Atlanta. He moderated a panel discussion on the death penalty. It's a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Oh, thank you for having me.
time to add a couple more tunes to the Georgia playlist. We ask people to choose two songs they think best represent the Peach State. And the rules are simple. The nominations have to be songs written or performed by a Georgian, and it can't be one of their own songs. So let's add two more tracks to our essential Georgia playlist.
Hey, I'm Rochelle, Hot 16, on the road to 8 Grammys. I'm a hip-hop performer based out of Atlanta, Georgia. So for the first song I wanted to talk about for the Georgia playlist is a group called Vintage Nation. Their song's titled 'Cause I'm Black. They're based in Atlanta, Georgia. The reason I chose their song 'Cause I'm Black is because I felt like they were empowering the culture. And during a time where a lot of things are happening to black kids right now, I just feel like that our culture just needs some uplifting, empowering music, and that's what they bring to the table. And with their little chant that they do in their song, it's just, you could say it and feel good about yourself. The message about education and everything that she talks about or sings about in the song is just really great. Stay in school and get your education. Don't let them come and come and put away. You got to be patient. Quit hating. I love the way, like, the horns play throughout the record and the melody. It's just very soulful, and it really takes you to a place where music is good and powerful and stands for something. Honestly, I think it's kind of like every African-American story in a sense. You know, it's not necessarily like a story form, but, you know, we are just talented, amazing individuals. The second song I wanted to choose is B.O.B. Airplanes. He's a rapper based out of Decatur. Can we pretend that airplanes in the night sky like shooting stars? I could really use a wish right now, wish right now, wish right now. Man, he beat me to the punch. I wanted to do a record with Hayley Williams from Paramore. Yeah, I could use a dream or a genie or a wish to go back to a place much simpler than this. Cause after all the partying and smashing and crashing and all the glitz and the glam and the fashion and all the pandemonium. He's talking about, you know, after the girls and the fame and the fashion, how it goes back to blackness and, you know, nobody picking up your phone call type deal. And, you know, I thought, like, yeah, sometimes you get caught up in everything and it's not about just, you know, your relationships, your money and different things like that. You know, I don't believe that he did music for that reason, and he started to realize that in that song. In that airplane, in the night sky, like shooting stars. I can really use a wish right now, wish right now, wish right now. Can we pretend that airplane's in the night sky, like shooting stars? I can really use a wish right now, wish right now, wish right now. I would describe the Georgia sound as a fun kind of vibe to it, and kind of onomatopoeia, kind of rapping, hard-hitting drums, you know, a dance kind of vibe to it with a, you know, a heavy southern accent kind of to add that twang to it.
That was Rochelle Hot 16. She's a hip-hop artist in Atlanta, and those are her picks for our Georgia playlist. Do you have a couple picks of your own? You can tweet us at OST Talk or call 404-500-9457. And if you're going to leave a message, you might as well sing a little. You can find all of our Georgia playlist picks at gpb.org/onsecondthought. Mm-hmm. I'm Celeste Headlee. This is On Second Thought. 2016 is the year of Georgia music. Every month we'll bring you conversations with and about the musicians of the Peach State. Today, a man who has influenced countless songwriters and singers, William Bell. Singer, songwriter himself, producer, and he's been based out of Atlanta since 1970. He joins us now to talk about his career and what kind of music from Georgia has inspired him. It's a real honor. Welcome.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
So tell me what it's like when a number of your songs have been covered by other artists, and some of them have sounded nothing like the original. And you probably know the one I'm thinking of, which is Billy Idol did a version of Forgot to Be Your Lover. So what is that like? Do you think that in a cover like that, because there's been a number, even Otis Redding covered one of your songs. There's been a whole bunch of people who've covered your songs that you did originally. What is that like when they make substantial changes to your song? Is that bothersome?
And no, it isn't, you know, because I like for an artist to individuality is what makes an artist, and I like for an artist to be an artist. Sometimes it takes me a minute to really process how they heard a certain, like Billy Idol, he took a ballad, a sensitive ballad, and made it the up-tempo thing, but he actually identified with the lyrical content and everything, and he made it his, which was great. And, of course, I can't argue with the success of it. So, but I love for an artist to take something that I've created or written and make it theirs.
You know, did you and he have a conversation about it ever?
No,
either
not
before
ever.
He recorded it or after? Never.
Never. I got a copy of it from the label before they released it, and when I first got the copy, they were asking what I thought about it, and I said, well, I'm going to hold my opinion for a minute and let me live with it for a while. So after 3 or 4 days, I kind of got it, and I called them back. I said, great.
But it took you 3 or 4 days.
Yeah,
that
it
must
did.
Have been
it really did, because I'm going, okay, how did he hear this, that lyrical part of this? And it took me a minute to get it, yeah.
So that brings us to the issue of sampling, which your music has also been sampled a lot. And I wanted to play you a comment from Snoop Dogg. You were part of a documentary called Take Me to the River, where they paired younger artists with some of the veterans. And you actually were paired with Snoop Dogg. And he said some interesting things. Here's one of them.
My grandparents and my mother, and they inspired me by playing this good music when I was young, you know, to turn me on to it. To hit me to it and to make me love it. It's a respect thing. Hip-hop is the dominant music right now. So I say that to say this. When those brothers take the time out of their careers to say, we want to dedicate this song and this title to somebody who inspired us, who wasn't a hip-hop artist, respect that.
I wonder if that's how you feel about sampling. Do you hear it as respect?
I do. I do. Anytime an artist can find something that I've created that they can relate to and bring it up to fit their generation. Yeah, I do have respect for that. There are a lot of writers and performers that don't like that, but it doesn't bother me, I guess, because I'm also into the creative process. And when an artist comes forth with a totally original take on something that I've done, I like it. I mean, it's cool.
Okay. Not every artist is great at writing music for other people. And those who write well for other people aren't always so great at writing for themselves. Do you know what I mean?
I know.
Many people write songs for themselves that they can sing, but they don't translate to any other. You're nodding your head, so you know exactly what I mean.
Yes.
How do you, is that a skill that you have to learn, or is that something you're just either born with or not?
Well, it's a process to where if you're going to write a song, I write about life, and hopefully that people identify with it. My lyrical content is all about life. I try to gear my melodies so that they're easily recognizable. But if I write specifically for another artist, I try to get inside that artist's persona. You know,
how do you do that, though?
Well, you talk with the artist, or you listen to his past history of performances or what he's about, or try to read up on him or her, and how their life has evolved, and you write about that. You know, like in writing for, say, Albert King, I knew that he didn't read or write, so inclusive in that song, I wrote a lyric about I can't read, didn't learn how to write. And these were things that he could identify with as an artist.
Do you find that that gets a more emotional performance out of them? What difference does it make when you're putting things in there that they can instantly relate to?
Yeah, that does touch them emotionally, because if there's something that you can relate to, you can easily, readily get into it. As there are a lot of people that hear a song and say, oh, God, I could have written that if I was a writer, because that's my life. And so they readily identify with it. So emotionally, they are more drawn to it if it's something that they can identify with lyrically.
So let's talk about you as a singer instead of a songwriter for just a moment. And let's hear a little bit to your performance in the White House. President Obama and Michelle Obama sitting right in front of you. This is 2014. And let's hear a little bit. You were singing probably one of your best known songs, You Don't Miss Your Water.
In the beginning, and I was too blind, and I couldn't see.
And Booker T on the keyboards.
I mean, it doesn't get any better than
no.
that. And, of course, it was like old home week with Booker and Sam and Eddie and all the gang there from Stax and some of the musicians. It was just great, and you're performing for the president. I mean,
how do you not
choke
up?
Where do you go from the right? Well, you know, I'm comfortable on stage, and I try, and as long as I know that the musicians are comfortable and vocally I'm good to go, you know, I'm comfortable on stage. I didn't really get nervous or anything with that. Probably a little apprehensive, because when you're going into a situation where you said, okay, this is the top dignitary of the world.
And the first African-American president of the United States.
Yeah, so it's historical and everything else.
Oh, it's a moment.
Yeah, so all of that, but you process it, and when you get on stage, you put that behind you and go for the performance.
You know, I wonder what you think about some of the current methods we have of identifying talent. And by that, I mean, your story to a certain extent is kind of iconic, right? I mean, you came up singing in the church and then kind of hard scrabbled your way, that you have a long history of really hard work and just sort of hustling to get where you were. And so when you watch like American Idol or some of the competition choice of shows, The Voice or the X Factor, is there a ideal way to identify talent? Is it better to like have someone discover it, or is it better when somebody has to really work for it?
Well, I think real talent, authentic talent, I think is a gift. You can hone it, hone the craft. You can learn more about the process of it. But the actual talent is really a gift that to be cherished. I like The Voice the way they do. They turn around and...
Because they're blind auditions.
Yeah, it's a blind audition. You're totally listening for the interpretation, the vocal range, and all of that. You don't care about the look right at this moment. You're listening for that signature sound, that voice, and how they interpret a lyric and how heartfelt it is. And so that's, to me, very important.
So weigh in a little bit on some of the other discussions we're having, especially around soul music, because there's a lot of arguments over appropriation of soul music and when it's appropriate for an artist to sing it and when it isn't. Did you ever have those kind of thoughts about soul music that comes out of your personal experience or soul music that is part of your background as a young African-American, especially when you're writing some of these things, and whether or not it's then appropriate for a white artist or someone else to come in and then sing that piece of music?
I don't have any apprehensions about it. I think if they can relate to it, great. Like I said, I write about life. I write about personal experiences, some things from observation, And even if I just take a hypothetical situation and write about it, I try to write it in such a way that I think the ordinary lay person can identify with it, you know. So when a person can take a piece of music or something and do that, I don't have any problems with that. You know, it's like I'm good with it.
So I wonder, I mean, you're talking about world music and how widespread music is, and it is. It's readily available. I can hear something from, you know, Bangladesh if I feel like it. Has that removed some of our characteristics of different regions? Do we still, for example, have a southern sound anymore?
We do. We definitely, it's funny because you asked that. I heard Uptown Funk as
performed by Bruno Mars.
Yeah, but Boo Mitchell was a part of that. I didn't know at the time, but he's in the film with me. So we were riding from Austin to Dallas in a car, and the record came on. Instantly, I knew that was a Memphis record. And I'm going, I didn't know who it was because the first time I had heard it, I'm going, hold on, guys, who is that? And he said, oh, that's the record that we cut on Bruno Mars. That's Uptown Funk.
But what did you hear?
There's a certain sound, a drum sound that High Records has that it's undeniable. You know, it's like all that Al Green stuff and all. That sound I told Boo, you should just lock that into a gold cage and keep it there. And he does. He just locks up. He never takes the drums down.
Or moves them,
anything. He'll lock the drum booth after everybody does a session, you know. But there's just something about the sound and the feel of the musicians when they're cutting in certain regions that you just recognize it.
So do we have an Atlanta? I mean, you've been in Atlanta for decades now. Is there an Atlanta sound then?
You know what? I don't hear an Atlanta sound, and the reason being you have great studios, great musicians here, but there's no one entity like a group of musicians that cut enough together to establish that particular feel. So you always incorporate a lot of different musicians and talent when you go into a recording session. They get hit records out of it, but they don't establish that signature sound like out of New Orleans
or Detroit or
Muscle Shoals or something.
But one of the things that makes, I know Detroit quite well, one of the things that makes their sound so recognizable is because they have the same group of like 100 musicians who play on everything.
Right.
Punk, techno, everything. And you'll walk in and you'll see the same guy that played on the country song.
Absolutely.
So maybe we don't have that here in Atlanta.
We do not have that here in Atlanta. It's not musicians are more individualized here. Great musicians, but individualized. Whereas you have what I call cliques of musicians, sets of musicians that play on everything over at like Stax Records or over at High Records or down in New Orleans, you know, and so you establish that sound. They play enough together to where they just read each other's minds. And you had that for a long time out in California back in the 60s, early 60s, with a lot of those musicians and played on everything.
Everything. It's true. Playing on Soul Records, playing on the Beach Boys, same cats.
Absolutely.
All right, so before we go, what's on your playlist? What are you listening to?
Everything from classical to pop to country, because that's me. I've listened to everything my whole life. When I was a kid, I was listening to the Four Freshmen and Sam Cooke and you name it. I mean,
we are aging a whole generation of incredible musicians. When I think about those like yourself who are getting older and Bill Withers and this whole generation of people who just defined a moment in music, is there anybody rising up to sort of take that mantle on, or are we just set that sort of era in soul music aside?
I think there are some good artists out there. They haven't reached their peak yet, so you know they're not household names. Yeah, but John Legend, I think, will be around for a minute. I think a long time, because he has a signature sound and he's a great writer and everything. I think he's going to be here for a while. Ed Sheeran is going to be here, of course, even with her sound is more popish, but Taylor Swift will be around for a while because she's a good writer. And there are a lot of other artists. I'm missing a lot of them, but there are some up-and-coming new talent that really has it going on, got it going on, and they're going to be here for a while. It's just it takes time to establish their niche within the industry.
And maybe find their voice.
Yeah, absolutely.
I've been speaking with singer-songwriter William Bell. It's such a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Oh, thank you. My pleasure.
That's our show for today. Tomorrow is Election Day, though. Are you voting? Donald Trump is expected to win here in Georgia. Why do you think that is? Call us at 404-500-9457. You can also tweet us at OST Talk or post in Facebook. For today, that's On Second Thought from GPB News. I'm Celeste Headlee. Have a great day.